Welcome to America's Providential History Podcast, where we talk about the real story of America and explore the hand of God in our history. Now, here's your host, Stephen McDowell.
Hello, I'm glad you're joining us for this edition of America's Providential History Podcast. Today and next week, we will be exploring Christianity, the source of America's liberty and independence. On July 8, 1776, the Liberty Bell rang out in the State House in Philadelphia, calling together the citizens to hear the first public reading of the Declaration of Independence, which had been approved by the Congress, the Continental Congress meeting in Philadelphia just 4 days before. Now, the Liberty Bell was not called the Liberty Bell at that time, but given the name after. But this bell that had been hanging in the State House in Pennsylvania had been cast a few decades before, and providentially, that around the top of the Liberty Bell is engraved a scripture, Leviticus 25:10, which says, "Proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all the inhabitants thereof." Now, the context of this scripture is in the Jubilee year of liberty. God set up for the children of Israel many provisions that would help secure their God-given rights and liberties, one of which was the right to possess and own property and use that property to be productive. But in the Jubilee year, this was a time when all property was returned to the original owners. All slaves were set free. All debts were forgiven in the Jubilee Year of Liberty, which occurred every 50 years. Now, this is a very important scripture to be used at this time, because with the birth of the United States of America, a new era of liberty was coming to mankind. This was something the founders understood and recognized. Reverend Jonas Clark, who we'll mention here later, who is the pastor of the church at Lexington, Massachusetts, and it was members of his church that were part of those Minutemen that were fired upon that when the first shot heard round the world took place. But he declared, "From this day will be dated the liberty of the world." From what day? From the day of the events that precipitated our struggle for independence and the eventual gaining of our independence as a nation. With the birth of the United States of America about 250 years ago, what we see is a new era of liberty coming to mankind. The world had seen nothing like the type of liberty that came forth in the birth of this nation. Now, the reason that a new era of liberty was coming to mankind is because this external liberty that came forth with our birth as a nation was a product of the internal liberty in the hearts and the minds of the citizens that had been sown and prepared for generations prior to these events. And key to this preparation, this internal liberty, the founders spoke of often. George Washington, in his farewell address after serving two terms as president, said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." The founders recognized that the foundation for a free nation, for political prosperity, religion and morality. Now, when our founders used the word religion, they meant Christianity. That was true religion to them, as defined by Noah Webster in his original dictionary. So Christianity and Christian character or morality, which flows from the Christian faith, are indispensable supports for freedom, for liberty, for political prosperity. And so the American people had been prepared in Christian homes and by the churches and the schools that existed, which were thoroughly biblical. They had been prepared internally, given the character and worldview necessary to support external liberty. That's why when they bell rang out and said, we're going to proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all the inhabitants thereof. A new era of liberty that was based upon the Christian faith was coming to mankind. You see, Christianity is the source of liberty. All liberty, not just personal liberty. You know, 2 Corinthians 3:17 says, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. When the Spirit of God comes into the heart of man, he is liberated. He's set free from the bondage of sin and restored to a liberating relationship with the Creator of all things. But it's also true when the Spirit of God comes and is infused within a nation, within a family, within a nation, that nation is liberated as well to the degree that it adopts and obeys the principles of the Christian faith. See, Christianity is the source of liberty for man. Yes, first internal liberty, personal liberty, but also all external forms of liberty that flow forth from it. Religious liberty, political liberty, economic liberty, civil liberty. All liberty is a product of the Christian faith, directly or indirectly in the hearts and minds of people. Historian David Ramsey said, there can be no political happiness without liberty, and there can be no liberty without morality, and there can be no morality without religion. See, in other words, Christianity produced morality, Christian character, and this religion and morality were the source of liberty. And that liberty leads to political happiness and so many other great blessings in civil society. This is something that the founders of America, the early Americans, understood this very important principle very well. Noah Webster, the father of American scholarship and education, most influential educator, if not person, in the 19th century, who wrote on many, many subjects in future podcasts. We'll look at Noah Webster's life. But he said almost all the civil liberty now enjoyed in the world owes its origin to the principles of the Christian religion. The religion which has introduced civil liberty is the religion of Christ and his apostles. So he said, almost all the civil liberty enjoyed in the world owes its origin to the principles of the Christian religion. Christianity produces liberty, not just personal liberty, but also civil liberty. The religion which has introduced civil liberty is the religion of Christ and his apostles. Christianity is the source of liberty in the world, and it's certainly the source of liberty in the United States of America. Benjamin Rush, third most famous founding father, signer of the Declaration, father of medicine in America, said that Christianity is the only true and perfect religion, and that in proportion as mankind adopt its principles and obeys its precepts, they will be wise and happy. So it's, of course, not just the Christian faith in a general sense, but it's a people, not just a people who profess to believe in the Christian faith, but it's a people who adopt the principles of Christianity and obey the precepts taught by the Christian faith. This is what makes them wise and happy, blessed, prosperous, and free. Charles Clay was Thomas Jefferson's pastor, first in the Anglican Church that he was a member of before independence. After independence, Thomas Jefferson started his church, and he invited his evangelical Anglican pastor, who was a patriot, Charles Clay, to become the pastor of this new church that met in the courthouse in Charlottesville. He called it the Calvinistical Reformed Church of Charlottesville, and in future podcasts, we'll explore more about this man, Thomas Jefferson, but his pastor, Charles Clay, preached an artillery sermon in 1777 in which he declared the sacred cause of liberty is the cause of God. He has just about every one of our founding fathers and early Americans understood that God is the author of liberty. God is the one who came to liberate man, not just from the internal bondage of sin, but also from the external fruit of sin. Galatians 5:1 said it was for freedom Christ came to set us free. Yes, that freedom begins by internally, by freeing us from the bondage of sin, but it doesn't stop there. Because if you're truly liberated from within, it can't help but impact every aspect of your life. It will impact how you live, your family and the relationship in the family. It'll affect your business, your interaction with the community, you fulfilling your duties in the various spheres of life. If you're truly liberated from within, then gradually that internal liberty will begin to flow out and bring external liberty. In his inaugural address, Jesus declared, Luke 4:18, that the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, among other things, to proclaim liberty. Christ came to liberate man, liberate mankind, to liberate men, and to liberate nations. Now, certainly, the story of America's independence reveals there would be no liberty without Christianity. There would be no America without the Christian faith. In an earlier podcast, we've began to look at that in different ways, and we'll continue to emphasize this important principle in future America's Providential History podcast. And by the way, we've written many books and materials related to this subject. You can visit our website, providencefoundation.com. to see some of these, read many articles, and watch videos and learn much more. But what I want to look at in this and next week's podcast is the direct relationship of the Christian faith to our independence, to the events leading up to the American Revolution. Future podcasts will actually look at events in the American Revolution and how God supported the cause of American liberty. Now, the story of America's independence really begins hundreds of years before the events that we think of with the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. And some of those events we've touched on before. But where I want to begin now is about 10 years before the outbreak of fighting in the War of Independence and the signing of the Declaration, around 1764, 1765, some of those events. This is really kind of some of the beginning phases of the American Christian Revolution, because a revolution, it begins with ideas and principles way before it begins with any kind of fighting. That certainly was true in the United States of America. And so around that year, 1764, 1765, King George III and the English Parliament levied a tax against the American colonies to help pay for a war that had just ended. It's called the French and Indian War, and this was a conflict that not only was taking place in the colonies, but in Europe as well, where in the colonies, part of the conflict was over disputes on the western boundaries of who owned the territory. Was it British or the French? And of course, wars cost money, and since part of this war was fought in the colonists and the British sent troops over to help in this conflict, they thought, hey, the Americans ought to help pay for this war. Now, the Americans weren't opposed to paying for their defense. What they were opposed to and what was new in these taxes enacted upon the colonists was that the king believed that he had a right to tax the colonists without their consent. Now, other taxes and prior to this levied upon the colonists were agreed to by their own elected representatives, their own officials who lived here in the colonies. But the king believed, no, I have a right to tax them. And so one of those taxes was the Stamp Act. And in order, any kind of official papers or other things that were done, it had to have this stamp on it, which you had people had to buy, and it was a tax upon them. And so the colonists, when this came about, began to protest, began to speak out. Now, they began to recognize that, hey, our rights as British citizens are being violated. We had no, gave no consent to these taxes, and if the king can take our property without our consent or the voice of our representatives, then we have no right to property at all, was their reasoning. And that's why many people began to speak out against this. Now, one of those men who early on began to resist and speak out was Patrick Henry. Now, in 1765, Patrick Henry was a newly elected member of the Virginia legislature. It's called the House of Burgesses. This was his first term of office. And so when he attended this first meeting in Williamsburg, which is where the capital was in Virginia at that time, that as a new delegate, he wanted to sit and listen and learn. And of course, central to the debates that were going on were regarding this unjust, what they considered to be an unjust tax, the Stamp Act. And so Patrick Henry was sitting, listening to all the debates. Some were speaking out, yeah, this is wrong. But many people were saying, but we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to get the king mad. And let's just wait and see what happens. And so there's debate back and forth, and seemed like nothing was getting done. And during this time, Patrick Henry wrote some resolves down on a piece of paper that he had. And after quite some time of a debate going nowhere, he finally stood up and he introduced these resolves, saying this is something we should agree to. In essence, he was saying the tax is unjust. We demand that the king repeal this Stamp Act. Now, Patrick Henry would later write about this incident, and he said, upon offering them to the House, speaking of the resolves that he'd written down, these various points, violent debates ensued. Many threats were uttered and much abuse cast on me by the party for submission. It was during his giving arguments for why they needed to demand the king and the parliament repeal this tax that Patrick Henry gave one of his famous speeches. And during his speech, he said that Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I his Cromwell, and George III... Treason, treason, shouted the Speaker of the House. Treason, treason, echoed from every part of the room. Without faltering for an instant and fixing on the Speaker an eye that flashed fire, the orator added, may profit by their example. If this be treason, make the most of it. Now, why did they cry out treason in the midst of his giving his defense of these resolves? Well, when he said Caesar had his Brutus, what happened to Caesar because of Brutus? Well, he was killed. He was put to death. Charles I, his Cromwell, under the principles of the Cromwell in the mid-1600s in England, the tyrannical king Charles I was off with his head. He was removed from office permanently. And then he mentioned Caesar, mentioned Charles I, and George III. And so some were thinking maybe he's calling for the killing of the king in this matter. And that's why they were shouting treason, treason. And Patrick Henry said, may profit by their example. If this be treason, make the most of it. Now, during this debate that was taking place and the introduction of these resolves, there was a young law student standing there at the doorway listening to all these things by the name of Thomas Jefferson. And so Thomas Jefferson heard this, and he wrote of the incident saying, I attended the debate of the door of the lobby of the House of Burgesses, and heard the splendid display of Mr. Henry's talents as a popular orator. They were great indeed, such as I have never heard from any other man. He appeared to me to speak as Homer wrote. In fact, he went on to say that then and there, I became a changed man. Under the great influence of this mighty orator, in fact, Thomas Jefferson would call Patrick Henry the greatest orator that he'd ever heard, in fact, that ever lived. And Jefferson wasn't given to superlatives for people like this. So he was greatly impacted in his life by listening to the arguments and great speech of Patrick Henry. Changed his life, impacted his life, and helped direct where he would go in his life. Well, Patrick Henry, his writings, looking back over these events, he wrote down what was taking place, and then he wrote this. After a long and warm contest, the resolutions passed by a very small majority, perhaps one or two only. The alarm spread throughout America with astonishing quickness. The great point of resistance to British taxation was universally established in the colonies. This brought on the war, which finally separated the two countries and gave independence to ours. Whether this will prove a blessing or a curse will depend upon the use our people make of the blessings which a gracious God hath bestowed on us. If they are wise, they will be great and happy. If they are of a contrary character, they will be miserable. And then he goes on to say, righteousness alone can exalt them as a nation. Reader, whoever thou art, remember this. So in other words, he's speaking to us today. He's writing about this. We're reading this. We're listening to this. And so he's, again, here's a man. One man stood up. One man made a difference in what took place here. And then he's leaving advice. Righteousness exalts, can alone exalt them as a nation. Reader, whoever out there art, remember this, and in thy sphere practice virtue thyself and encourage it in others. So we would do well to listen to the advice of Patrick Henry at this very important moment, this turning point in the events that led up to our American independence. The resolutions, Patrick Henry wrote, form the first opposition to the Stamp Act and the scheme of taxing America by the British Parliament. So because this man stood up, then he rallied those in the legislature in Virginia who voted closely to, yes, let's demand that let's act against this. Let's demand this tax be repealed. And people not only there, but in Massachusetts and other places also began to stand up to resist the tyrannical action of the king who violated their rights as British citizens, as citizens of the earth, and as Christians, as Samuel Adams would write in a famous tract a few years after this. And so because of Patrick Henry, influence, he was hailed as the leader raised up by Providence for the occasion. Now, because of Henry and Virginia legislature and people in Massachusetts and others, the Stamp Act was repealed. And not only was it repealed, but there was a celebration, recognition of its repeal. And one thing that was done in different places was that they proclaimed days of prayer and thanksgiving. And it wasn't just churches that proclaimed this, but it was civil governments as well. Up in Massachusetts, in 1766, the legislature proclaimed a day of thanksgiving to Almighty God throughout the province of the Massachusetts Bay in New England. And on these days, which as we've mentioned in past podcasts, that this was a very usual event, you know, for over 1,400 times civil governments proclaimed days of prayer and fasting or prayer and thanksgiving in New England during our first couple of hundred years. And so not only did they proclaim this day, but they invited a minister to come and preach to the legislature. And Reverend Charles Chauncey preached from Proverbs 25:25, a discourse on the good news from a far country. And what was the good news? As it says on the reprint of his sermon, these election sermons, Thanksgiving sermons, fast day sermons were often printed and distributed among the people and read and became their political textbooks, shaped their worldview. But as it says on the cover of the sermon, the occasion for this discourse was the repeal of the Stamp Act. So the very fact that a tax was repealed precipitated the legislature proclaiming a day of thanksgiving, sermons were preached, people rejoiced, and today, if we would ever repeal taxes, I would rejoice as well, and gladly to preach a Thanksgiving Day sermon to recognize the occasion. And so, again, right there on the cover of the reprinted sermon of the discourse on the good news from a far country delivered on July 24th, 1766. It was delivered on a day of thanksgiving to Almighty God throughout the province of the Massachusetts Bay and New England on the occasion of the repeal of the Stamp Act. And there were many other sermons preached as well to recognize that. Well, that tax was repealed, but the king still believed he had the authority to tax the colonists without their consent. And so with the king's emphasis and the approval of Parliament, other taxes were enacted. The Townshend Act in 1767, the Tea Act of 1773. Now, when the Tea Act was passed, it placed a tax on tea that was sold in the colonies. Now, the colonies loved to drink tea, as their English brethren did as well. But when this unjust tax was imposed upon the tea, the colonists said, okay, we just won't drink tea. We'll drink coffee or something else. We're not going to drink tea because it has this unjust tax. And so when they failed to buy the tea from England, the tea began to pile up in the warehouses of the businessmen, English businessmen who sold them the tea, and then they petitioned the Parliament, said, hey, you've got to do something. We're not selling our tea because the colonists are refusing to buy it, so you better do something to help us out. So what the Parliament did, they decided, okay, well, we'll just subsidize the British tea. We'll give to you the difference in the taxes that have been imposed, and so the tea once again will be cheaper than it was when after the tax was levied, and the Americans will buy it again. Well, that didn't do any good. It wasn't the cost of the tea, the price of the tea, that determined what the colonists did, but it was the principle. In fact, Benjamin Franklin spoke of this. He said that they, speaking of the Parliament, have no idea that any people can act from any other principle but that of interest. And they believe that 3 pence on a pound of tea, which one does not perhaps drink 10 pounds in a year, is sufficient to overcome all the patriotism of an American. See, they thought everybody, the Americans, are going to be motivated by money. And that wasn't the primary thing that motivated them. And they thought, you know, as Franklin said, it's just that small amount of money is sufficient to overcome all the patriotism of an American. Well, today, unfortunately, there's probably many Americans that would be sufficient to overcome their patriotism or any principles that they have. Thankfully, not it didn't then. Well, colonists, even though the subsidized cost of the tea made it the price that it was before or so, that they still refused. We're not going to buy the tea. And so the English government then declared, well, sell it anyway. And so they ordered for ships to carry the tea to the colonists and forced the colonists to buy the tea. Now, when the Americans got word of this, the colonists got word of this, and that in particular, there are five ports, different cities that where these ships were coming to sell the tea. Well, they organized and they forbid the ships to land in the ports that carried the tea. Now, in four of the cities, they were turned back and never did land. But in Boston, the ship was able to get through and to land at the port. Well, the colonists then began to gather together to say, what can we do? And they had a meeting at the Old South Church there in Boston where 7,000 people gathered at the meeting house to discuss how are we going to respond to this incident. Now, they said, they took a guard and put a guard at the port to forbid the ship to be unloaded while they discussed what is our line of action. Now, the owner of the ship was a private businessman, a Mr. Rutch. Mr. Rutch was given an ultimatum by the British authorities, you unload your tea by this particular date or we're going to confiscate your ship and its goods. So Mr. Rutch went there at the meeting where the Massachusetts citizens met at Old South Meeting House and was explaining to them, you know, you got to help me. I'm caught here in the middle. And so the result of all this, the colonists weren't going to buy the tea. They didn't want to hurt Mr. Rutch and his ship. So they decided, well, the only thing we can do is have a Boston Tea Party, is what we called it. In other words, they decided we're going to go and we're going to just unload the tea ourselves and dump it in the British harbor as a means of protest. Now, Governor Hutchinson, he was the governor of Massachusetts at this time, wrote about what transpired there and at the end of 1773. He said, the party in disguise, whooping like Indians. Now, the colonists dressed up as Indians. It wasn't to implicate the Indians, but it was so that no one American could be identified by the British as the person who carried on this action and be punished for it. So, you know, when they were asked, well, who did it? Well, I don't know. They were just a bunch of Indians who don't know who did it. So they were, in other words, saying we're going to all take the blame, not any one or two or few people. Everyone is going to take the blame. So Hutchinson wrote, the party in disguise, whooping like Indians, went on board the vessels and warning their officers and those of the custom house to keep out of the way, unlaid the hatches, hoisted the chests of tea on deck, cut them open, and hove the tea overboard. They proved quiet and systematic workers. No one interfered with them. No other property was injured. No person was harmed. No tea was allowed to be carried away. And the silence of the crowd on shore was such that the breaking of the chest was distinctly heard by them. Hutchinson wrote that the whole was done with very little tumult. So here it is. Now, some modern people have represented the people at the Boston Tea Party as a bunch of drunks who were down at the bar. What are we going to do? And had too much to drink. Said, let's just go and have a party and throw the tea overboard. That's not what it was at all. This was a principled response by biblically thinking people as a last resort of the way to resist the tyrant. This is we've been backed in the corner. All we can do, we're not buying the tea. We don't want to hurt Mr. Rutch. So we're going to just protest by throwing the tea in the harbor, which, by the way, was they offered later to pay for the tea. But as you notice, no other property was harmed. No tea was allowed to be carried away as well. Well, after what we have come to know as the Boston Tea Party, the response of the king, King George III, was to close the port of Boston. He said, okay, you know, I'm going to teach you guys a lesson. So he declared that on June 1st, 1774, the port of Boston would be closed. That 90% of the trade or business in Boston took place in and out of the port. So in essence, this was a way to squeeze the life out of the Bostonians and force them, you're going to submit and buy the tea or do what I say. And so the colonists then, when they got word of this, they began to consider, what can we do? How can we respond? And it wasn't just the people in Boston, but throughout the colonies. Down in Virginia, the House of Burgesses, that was the elected legislature, the people of Virginia, they met together to discuss, how can we respond to this action of the king and this port bill in June 1st, 1774? Well, a number of states said, well, we're going to proclaim a day of prayer and fasting. In Virginia, Thomas Jefferson, who is a member of the legislature, he was the one who wrote a resolve setting aside the first day of June, 1774, as a, I'm quoting, a quote, a day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer, devoutly to implore the divine interposition, to give to us one heart and one mind, firmly to oppose by all just and proper means every injury to American rights. So they said, we're going to have a day of prayer and fasting. We recommend everybody go to church to hear appropriate sermon, offer prayers, to stand with our brethren in Massachusetts to support them. And in his resolve, in the resolve passed by the legislature in Virginia, authored by Jefferson, it also ordered, therefore, that the members of the House do attend church and hear the Reverend Mr. Gwatkin to preach a sermon. And so on June 1st, 1774, in Williamsburg, Virginia, members of the Virginia legislature went up to Bruton Parish Church. It's about a half a mile up Duke of Gloucester Street from the Capitol on that very day. And to where they prayed, they heard a sermon by Mr. Gwatkin. And one person in attendance recorded that, never since my residence in Virginia have I seen so large a congregation as was this day assembled to hear divine service. So, of course, throughout Virginia, there people were going to church in their local churches and praying, hearing sermons appropriate for the occasion. And there in Williamsburg, the legislature, those that were there, gathered together as well. Now, the sermon delivered by Reverend Mr. Gwatkin on that day, the text was, be strong and of good courage. Fear not, nor be afraid of them. For the Lord thy God, he it is that doth go with thee. He will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. Thomas Jefferson wrote of this day, the people met generally with anxiety and alarm in their countenances. And the effect of the day through the whole colony was like a shock of electricity, arousing every man and placing him erect and solidly on his center. So here it was, the response of the colonists to an action of the king, which they considered to be a tyrannical action, unjust action by the king, was to gather together, to seek God, to cry out to him. First thing they did is said, we want to have prayer support. And they prayed, not only in Virginia, but in other states as well. And it wasn't just prayer support, but it was also material support. In Virginia, that there was an effort, private effort, this was not a governmental decree, but through a private effort, people went and collected offerings. George Washington was at the head of the list of who gave the most to give material support to the people of Boston as well, because their lifeblood was being squeezed out by the closing of the port So Virginians said, we're standing with you. We're praying for you. Here's money. We want to support you in the cause. So what we began to see is a very important biblical principle. This principle of a couple of principles. We see here unity with diversity. See, there were 13 independent colonies at this time. And they were made up of different denominations, from a number of different nations, different thinking churches, forms of government they had in these colonies. There's a great diversity, but there was also unity because Christianity provided the common set of ideas that united these people. They weren't united by external bonds, but by internal force of those distinctive ideas and principles that flowed from the Christian faith. John Adams recognized this when he said 13 clocks were made to strike together, a perfection of mechanism which no artist had ever before effected. He said that all 13 colonies began to work together to discuss what are we going to do to resist the tyrant, to act together. He said this was the greatest miracle of the war. There are many miracles that took place during the American Revolution, and we'll recover some of those in future podcasts, but probably the greatest miracle that occurred was that these 13 colonies could come together to act together to resist this unprincipled tyrannical action of the king and parliament. That's a miracle. You know, just imagine today if you get 13 churches that will come together to work as one for a common cause. That's hard enough to do that. And here you had 13 states with a great diversity, but there was that unity of the Christian faith and Christian worldview. And so we also see at work here this important Christian biblical principle of Christian union. There was unity with union. The 13 colonies began to come together and work together as one. And the reason that they could do that is because there was that unity of ideas that had been sown by the Christian families, by the churches and schools for 150 years or so. In fact, we see part of our national motto is E Pluribus Unum, the Latin, which means one from the many, out of the many, one. And so we began to see this miracle of Christian union began to occur through these events that we have begun to explore. Now, next week in our podcast, I want to pick up this story of how Christianity is the source of America's liberty and independence. Events where the colonists began to come together and operate as one, which eventually led to the birth of the United States of America, which brought a new era of liberty to mankind, which we still benefit from today, and nations around the world have been impacted and benefited because of the action of these colonists at this time. So I hope you can join us next week to where we will continue this story that is so important for us today. I want to remind you, if you want to read more about this, learn more, visit our website, providencefoundation.com. We have many books and materials, and two books I'll mention in particular that deal with this subject that we're talking about today. One is called The Bible, America's Source of Law and Liberty. And actually, one of the chapters I go through and cover this material I'm covering in these two podcasts, and there's many other things in there. This book, The Bible, America's Source of Law and Liberty, has actually been distributed to the legislators of 22 states in the United States today. There's 7,383 state legislators in our 50 states, and some years ago, we had a vision to get these books into the hands of the legislatures, and we reached half the states. And I'll let you know later how you might participate in getting this book to your state legislature as well. So that book and also America's Providential History, those are two important books that you can find on our website that will enable you to learn much more about this story of how Christianity formed the foundation of our liberty and independence. So I hope to have you with us next week when we continue this story. God bless you.